Decades ago, few pediatricians had heard of autism. In 1975, one in 5,000 kids were estimated to have it. Today, one in 68 are on the autism spectrum. What caused the steep rise? In his new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, journalist Steve Silberman answers this question by peeling back the layers of medical history that have altered the scope of autism diagnosis in the last century and revealing the perfect storm, if you will, of social forces that led to the sudden increase in diagnoses beginning in the late 1980s. This summer, Steve's TED Talk on the Forgotten History of Autism went live online and in less than 24 hours had garnered over 400,000 views. Again, the new book is Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And we welcome Steve Silberman to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Hey, Joe. Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. So this is a subject that is obviously certainly compelling from a journalistic point of view, also a very important subject, and also a rather controversial subject. What draw you?
Yes, that definitely.
Yes,
it's probably one of the most controversial subjects in America right now.
So what drew you to it?
Well, I wrote one of the first stories about autism in high-tech communities like Silicon Valley in 2001, a story called The Geek Syndrome. And unlike most magazine stories, I kept getting email from families and readers and people who had relatives who were on the spectrum for years afterwards, like 10 years afterward, I was still getting email. And what I noticed was that the people who were writing to me were not so much wondering, you know, what had made their kid autistic or what made them autistic or, you know, whether it was vaccines or whatever. What they were dealing with was the shocking lack of services for families and for autistic people as they transition out of high school and, you know, trying to enter the job market if they're capable of working or trying to live in the community if they're capable of doing that. And so I felt that society was having this long argument about what causes autism, but the actual daily problems that people were dealing with were much more related to services, employment, health, etc. And so this is my attempt to call attention to these important issues that are really what families are struggling with.
What do you think we can learn from the history? Learn from the history of the diagnosis and history of autism itself and how we define it?
Well, as you pointed out earlier, you know, in the 70s, the estimates of the prevalence of autism were much lower, and then you mentioned that now it's 1 in 68 kids are estimated to be on the autism spectrum. The whole secret of that is the word spectrum, because, you know, 50 years ago or even 35 years ago, there was no spectrum. Autism was defined very, very narrowly and very monolithically as a form of childhood psychosis. And the reason why the primary reason why the numbers have been going up so much in recent years is not because of vaccines or because of pesticides or any number of the other things that people are constantly speculating is causing the rise. The reason why the number of diagnoses has gone up so much primarily is because the definition of autism was radically rewritten to become a spectrum. And this was done primarily by a woman named Lorna Wing, who herself had a very profoundly disabled autistic daughter, and she was a cognitive psychologist in England. And she came up with the concept of the spectrum based on the insights of a guy named Hans Asperger, whose last name is probably familiar to many of your listeners, in Vienna. And Hans Asperger believed that autism was very common, that autism and autistic traits were not only very common, but that some of them were positive and had actually helped accelerate the evolution of science and technology and culture. But then along came a guy named Leo Kanner, who became really famous as the world's leading authority on autism, and he defined autism much more narrowly as this form of childhood psychosis caused by bad parenting. And, you know, so Kanner really sort of sent research in the wrong direction for a long time. But then Lorna Wing fixed it in the 80s, and that's when the numbers started going up.
You touched on this just a moment ago, but as we discussed, controversial subject. Why is it controversial? And give us a little bit of the history of that controversy.
Well, autism has always been controversial in that, you know, after Leo O'Connor blamed what became known as refrigerator mothers for causing autism, which of course was completely wrong and inflicted this terrible burden of shame and stigma on families, autism was kept quiet, and parents were told to remove their children's photos from their family albums and put the kids in institutions and move on with their lives. And so there was this sort of horrible, painful silence that prevailed. And then once it became known that there were many, many more autistic people than Connor would have admitted, people became sort of fascinated with autism. And this happened really after the release of Rain Man in 1988, because, you know, autism is, among other things, very, very interesting in that many autistic people have special talents in memory or in the ability to detect flaws and patterns. And so autism is this really interesting mixture of gifts and disabilities. And so it makes it a fascinating subject to talk about. But then, you know, really, the thing that made it most controversial in the recent era was that a guy named Dr. Andrew Wakefield, no longer a doctor in England, proposed that vaccines cause autism. And he admitted before he did that study that he, quote-unquote, knew nothing about autism. And then suddenly a couple of years later, after doing this study, he was, you know, considered an authority. And that was just a really misguided, it was a fraudulent paper, and then it was a very misguided direction to send the public dialogue about autism in. So all that time that we could have been talking about the services that families really need and the help that both autistic kids and autistic adults need, we ended up arguing about vaccines. And so it's still controversial. I understand why parents fear vaccines and pesticides and other aspects of the modern world. One of the reasons why I wrote the book was to make the rise in diagnoses explainable to parents in a way that was very human and very true and very relatable, instead of, you know, some public health official in Atlanta talking about broadened diagnostic criteria, et cetera.
Let's look at the title of the book itself, Neurotribes. Where does that come from, and this whole idea of neurodiversity and its future? What are you looking at there?
Well, the neurotribes is a word that I invented, although interestingly enough, I don't actually use it in the text of the book. I just wanted to use it as the title because it describes a different way of looking at people with conditions like autism and ADHD and dyslexia. Instead of seeing them as people with disorders and a checklist of deficits, it's interesting to think about them as people who have characteristic challenges that they struggle with every day, and also characteristic gifts that they can offer to society. So that's where Neurotribes comes from. The concept of neurodiversity was developed in an online group for autistic adults in the late 90s, and it's a way of looking at conditions like autism, dyslexia, and ADHD that takes it out of the medical model and includes the notion that these conditions also convey special gifts as well as some very serious challenges. And so it's a more positive way of looking at these conditions that does not deny the fact that they are very, very challenging and challenging for families, and that families really need more help from education systems, from the government, from just the local community, in order to build a better world for autistic people and their families.
How much do we still not know? What questions remain?
A tremendous amount. I mean, we're still not sure exactly what causes autism, which is, you know, it's a question that fascinates everyone, really.
Right.
I mean, we now know that genetics plays a very significant role in autism, but the genetics does not tell the whole story. Interestingly enough, we also know that the genetics of autism is very diverse. It's not like there's an autism gene. In fact, there are more than 1,000 candidate genes have been discovered that play some role in autism. But each autistic person is genetically quite unique. There's a saying in the autistic community, if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. And that turns out to be true even for geneticists. So, you know, there's obviously a lot of unknowns there. But one of the biggest unknowns that really needs more attention is how many autistic adults are there? Believe it or not, a major study of autism's prevalence in adults has never been done in the United States, or at least, you know, hasn't been done. It's never been done. And in England, they did do a prevalence study of adults living in the community, and this is a fascinating thing. What they discovered was that there were as many autistic adults, proportionately, as autistic children, which suggests that the true prevalence of autism has not gone up at all in recent years, and that the notion that there's a quote-unquote autism epidemic, which even the largest fundraising group, Autism Speaks, has, you know, spread that idea that there's an epidemic, which of course understandably terrifies parents, that's not a true idea. And as long as we think that there's an epidemic, we won't be helping autistic adults and their families lead happier, healthier, and safer lives.
So in the subtitle, when you say the future of neurodiversity, what do you think the future in this is? And the future as to what you just mentioned of living these healthy and happy lives?
Well, what we have to do is to find ways that autistic people can contribute the gifts of their atypical minds to their society and find ways to accommodate the sensory differences that are involved in autism, the differences in social interaction that are involved. You know, we have, as a society, we've been able to accommodate wheelchairs by making buildings accessible. We have found ways to make it possible for blind people and deaf people to live very independent and successful lives. But we have not even begun to do that yet with cognitive disabilities like autism. And that's the future, is figuring out ways to help people live more productive and engaged lives in their communities.
This book is 500 pages. I mean, it's exhaustive. And I'm curious as to, is there an aspect of this story that you became especially challenged by or consumed with, I will put it?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I uncover in the book is that historians have long believed that the two pioneers of autism research, Leo Kanner and Hans Asperger, made their discoveries of autism completely independently, although they announced them in papers that were published one right after the other. And so, you know, I had long wondered about that. It's considered one of the great coincidences of modern medicine. Well, I discovered that, in fact, it was not a coincidence at all, that, in fact, they did not discover autism independently, and that, in fact, Leo Kanner in Baltimore had hired Asperger's chief diagnostician, a guy named George Frankl, after saving him from the Holocaust by taking him from Vienna, which was controlled by the Nazis at the time, and bringing him to Baltimore. So that's one of those fascinating, you know, long-standing medical mysteries that I was actually able to solve by writing the book. And that fascinated me, because for so long it was considered, you know, like, oh, well, Kanner somehow never heard of Asperger, never read his paper or something. Well, you know, Asperger's paper was written in German, which was Kanner's native language, in a journal that he cited often in his papers, so it seemed implausible to me that he'd never read Asperger's paper. So that was, you know, one little thing that I got very consumed by.
I have to be honest, I couldn't, and this is as we wrap up, I couldn't help in reading this book think, as you tell these stories, as you look at this history, as you detail what we have just talked about over the last 15 minutes, that I guess you could do this about any malady, any disease, and it's just sort of scary what we don't know.
Well, that's true, although I personally wouldn't call autism a disease. But, yeah. No,
well, no, I didn't intend to, but I was just saying an illness, a malady, whatever the case, whether it's cancer or whether it is, there are certainly other things that are going on with our body that we have little or no, you know, we don't know a lot.
Well, yeah, that's definitely true. And in fact, one of the books that I would say was a model for my book was a book called The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer,
right,
by a guy named Siddhartha Mukherjee. It's a fascinating social history of cancer, and so that's what I tried to do for autism.
The name of the book is Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. The book is published by Avery. Steve Silberman, thank you very much for being with us. A pleasure.
Thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.